Hey, it's NPR's Book of the Day. I'm Andrew Limbaugh. Before we get into today's show, I want to tell you about a new offering we have here at Book of the Day. We have now launched Book of the Day Plus, which is a new way to support our work here at NPR. When you sign up, you get access to a special feed where you can listen to our new episodes sponsor-free. Nothing is changing about our regular show, but Book of the Day Plus is another way to help us keep giving you the books coverage you love. So please do sign up. We really appreciate it. You can find out more at plus.npr.org/bookoftheday. All right, on to today's show. I've had this half-formed hypothesis kicking around my head lately that so many of today's authors are drawn to writing historical fiction as a way of not having to deal with tech, you know, cell phones, social media, etc. And today's interview is just evidence to back me up on that. It's with the writer Amor Towles, whose new story collection is titled Table for Two. Most of the stories take place in the 90s or before, and he told NPR's Mary Louise Kelly that without the baggage of technology getting in the way of people, you can, quote, narrow it down to the more basic human interactions. That's after the break.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
At the very end of Amor Towles' first novel, Rules of Civility, his character, Evelyn Ross, is on a train. The year is 1938. She is pulling out of New York City, having just completely blown up her life there, and she's heading home to Indiana, except she doesn't get off where she's supposed to. All we're told is she has instead extended her ticket all the way to L.A. Well, as readers, we're left wondering, why? And did she make it? And what happened next to beautiful, brilliant, damaged Evelyn Ross? Well, it turns out Amor Towles was wondering, too. And so, last year, the author checked himself into the Beverly Hills Hotel and, as he puts it, finally gave Eve the story she deserved. The result is Table for Two, a collection of short stories, and the novella Eve in Hollywood. Amor Towles, hi there.
Hi, thank you, Mary Louise.
Is checking oneself into the Beverly Hills Hotel to write a novel as absolutely marvelous as it sounds?
Well, yeah, it's not the suffering artist
template. This is not hardship
journey. It's not the template of a suffering artist. No, it was. It's always fun to step into a place like that that you're writing about, sort of to instill your writing with sort of a slightly different mood than you would have while being at home.
Well, for any IRS auditors listening in, I will note this was a legit business expense.
Yes.
You do set most of the novella like by the pool and in the bar and in the suites of the Beverly Hills Hotel because your character Eve has checked in. Why?
When I was writing the passage in Rules of Civility in which Eve was going to arrive at the train station in Chicago where her parents were going to pick her up, as I was writing the paragraph, I stopped and thought, she would never get off that train.
Oh, you know, in a way, so she surprised you.
Yeah, she insisted that, really. So then I sort of on the spur of the moment, you know, it was like I had to kind of rethink and rewrite what happened to her. And she ends up extending her ticket to Los Angeles, which I guess to some degree is as far away as she could get from her parents without leaving the continental U.S., right? But she's attracted probably to the glamour of it, too, in the back of my mind. She's landing there in 1938, sort of the golden age of Hollywood. And she, I love Eve as a character, and she's a little bit of a troublemaker. She's pretty willful. She's very independent-minded. And so I kind of always thought, man, she's going to – I wonder what's going to happen to her in California because she's going to cause all kinds of trouble, I'm sure.
And she does.
Yeah, and so that was kind of the starting point. So I did all that without doing any applied research, without going to the hotel. I just did it as a work of imagination. I then did – to edit it, I went and moved into the Beverly Hills Hotel for, less than a week to edit it. And that's very typical.
Less than a week? I would have dragged it out for, I don't know, at least two.
Yeah, well, I know. You know, you're right. I mean, my wife and my kids were like, Dad, what are you doing? So, you know, you can only get so many days in a row. But this sort of opens the question of why. And different writers approach these things in different ways. But I am a person who does like to write something that I feel comfortable imagining. I'm a fan of Hollywood in the 30s, the movies, the society of it, and including the 40s. So I'd like to take something that I'm familiar with, imagine it fully, so that it's not weighed down by sort of the burdens of research. You know, I feel like when you do applied research, you can start to feel it in the prose. You know, it starts to be some things that are being clunked down into the narrative as landmarks, and they're not there organically, springing from the lives of the characters, springing from sort of the thematic integrity of the story. And so that's been a very fruitful process for me.
Speaking of Hollywood in the golden age of Hollywood, your plot here depends on the quaint notion that a photograph is exactly what it seems, could not be altered, that if, say, you had a compromising photo of a movie star, not clothed, that it is exactly what it looks like. Is that, I wondered as I read, is that part of why you set your novels all in the past? You don't have to deal with, like, pesky modern technology ruining your plot twists.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, and in Table for Two, there's six stories, all kind of end up in New York City, but five of them are around the millennium. Mm-hmm. But even that has become a long time ago, right? You know, because some of those are 1998, and the world today is so different from then in terms of what you're asking, in terms of what information we can get at our fingertips, how we communicate together, you know, all kinds of things have shifted pretty radically. And yes, it is refreshing for me as a writer to move back into a time where there's less of all of that, where there isn't a cell phone readily at hand, and there isn't Google, and there isn't email, there isn't, you know, big social networks, because you can start to narrow it down to the more basic human interactions, and that's very liberating. The Lincoln Highway, my last novel, is set in 1954, and you really, it's about four 18-year-olds who are friends, in essence, and to bring it back to that time allows you really to see the interactions in the most direct human-to-human fashion.
Well, and allows them to actually get lost on a road trip instead
of just
following the blinking pin on your Google map, et cetera.
Yeah, they can't find each other. They can't find each other.
Right. Explain the title, Table for Two.
Well, Table for Two, what ended up happening here is I gathered the six New York stories together. I took this brief, this, you know, shorter Even Hollywood, and expanded it into this longer text. I was preparing to hand in the manuscript to my publisher. And I really didn't have a title at that time. So you begin to sort of sift through, having just reread the manuscript multiple times as I'm editing it, sifting through, is there something there that sort of pulls us together? What really leapt out at me was that in almost every story, and in Eve, there are critical moments where there are two central characters sitting across from each other at a small table, often in a kitchen, and hashing out some significant element of their lives, which has come to the surface through the events of that particular story. Hmm. And I sort of thought, oh, that's sort of interesting. And I noticed it, let's say, for two or three stories. And then you kind of say, wait a second, what about, is it elsewhere? And then I realized, oh my God, it's in every one of them practically, so I think with one exception. And so then that sort of opens up this sort of notion of something must have been operating in the back of my mind or subconsciously about that space, about that moment when two people face each other, something has happened, they have an intricate relationship already, their relationship may be changing because of this incident that has occurred, something that has happened, and that they need to kind of begin to reorient themselves to each other, to themselves, as they face whatever the consequences are of this thing that has happened, whatever that thing is. And so that sort of powerful moment that we all can have with our spouse, with a child, with a sibling, at that sort of moment of one-on-one conversation across a table, suddenly I realized, you know, that it turned out to be a central theme that I wasn't really planning on, and thus the title.
Well, and it speaks again to that very basic level of human interaction that you can only have face-to-face and without the intervention of technology.
That's right. And I do like to think, metaphorically, of course, that an aspect of the Table for Two is me as the author and you as the reader. You know, the reading of this book is a version of the reader sitting across the table from me and us having a conversation, where I do most of the talking, but nonetheless, you know, a conversation.
Amor Towles, his wonderful new book is Table for Two. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Louise.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me. And I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on Black experiences. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.